The international community moves to open up a maritime humanitarian corridor to Gaza.
This corridor will enable the distribution of up to 2 million meals every single day.
Syria marks 13 years of war.
More than a decade later, the battles and the humanitarian crisis they have caused continue. For families on the front lines, the end is nowhere in sight.
Nigeria orders the creation of a new base to counter recent abductions.
The new police base will be in Kuriga, and deployment of extra officers to the area has begun.
Today is Thursday, March 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Steve Miller. Plumes of smoke and an explosion in Gaza were seen from southern Israel as the Israeli army deployed ground troops in the area near the border with the enclave. The Gaza Health Ministry says 88 Palestinians were killed and 135 injured during the past 24 hours. Now, those totals come as Israel says its airstrikes elsewhere on a UN food distribution center in southern Gaza killed a Hamas commander whom it was targeting. Well, the Palestinian health officials say it also killed four others, including a UN worker. The Israeli military says it's looking into the incident in Rafah. Now, in Washington, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was holding a video conference with officials from Cyprus, Britain, the UAE, Qatar, the European Union, and the United Nations to discuss getting a new maritime corridor for delivering humanitarian aid into Gaza up and running.
When established, this corridor will enable the distribution of up to 2 million meals every single day, as well as medicine, water, and other critical humanitarian supplies.
In Tel Aviv, Israel's defense minister said that aid coming in by sea will benefit the Palestinian civilians in Gaza and not Hamas. In addition, the Israeli military says it plans to direct many of the 1.4 million displaced Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip's southernmost town toward humanitarian islands located in the center of the territory ahead of its planned offensive of Rafah. The fate of those in Rafah has been a major area of concern of Israel's allies. Now, for additional updates on the Israel-Hamas war, please visit our website at voanews.com. Now, staying in the region, the Syrian civil war has faded from the headlines, but it's far from over. On the 13th anniversary of the war, rebel militaries and families on the front lines say battles there are intensifying and increasingly deadly. Moawiyah Atrash, Ahmed Falala, and Heather Murdoch bring us this story.
What began as peaceful protests in Syria in early 2011 quickly became a gruesome civil war. More than a decade later, the battles and the humanitarian crisis they have caused continue. For families on the front lines, the end is nowhere in sight. Khaladiya Sakai is a mother of eight, living in a village controlled by rebels, but constantly being bombed by the government and its allies. Every hour, every minute, all the time, she says. She says the villages nearby are also being bombed morning and night, and many people are dying. The government of President Bashar al-Assad controls most of Syria, but the United Nations says fighting in recent months has seen its largest escalation in 4 years, causing an unprecedented humanitarian crisis. In Idlib, emergency workers say the death toll in their region is rising. This is Yasin Khader, a volunteer for the Syrian Civil Defense. He says in 2023, there were 1,230 attacks in the area, killing more than 170 people and wounding 300. In the last half of the year, he says, there were continuous attacks in the south of the rebel-held areas. And commanders of rebels who control Idlib say they are not just planning to defend the area they currently control. Muhammad al-Bakur is a field commander for Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, the rebel group that controls most of Idlib. He says their plan was never to control the one region. The revolution continues, he says, until Assad is held accountable. While rebels are unlikely to overtake the Syrian government, the UN says battles with and between militant factions, as well as among international entities, including those entangled in the Israel-Hamas war, are deepening the humanitarian crisis. Today, nearly 17 million people in Syria need aid, the most since the war began. Violence and the lack of basic services, like water or electricity, are forcing people to flee their homes again and again. Again, this is Khalidia Sakai. She says there are no services in her village, and everyone is forced to be self-reliant. Some people do things like collect firewood in the forest just to survive. She says she believes the Syrian war may continue indefinitely, and there is very little hope access to aid will improve. The UN has called for a vast ramping up of aid and an immediate ceasefire, saying parties to the conflict have attacked civilians and infrastructure in ways likely amounting to war crimes. Heather Murdoch in Istanbul with Muawiyah Atrash and Ahmed Falaha in Idlib, Syria. VOA News.
We're also following these other stories from around the world. The U.S. House of Representatives on Wednesday passed a bill that would ban TikTok in the U.S. if its China-based owner doesn't sell. Lawmakers are concerned the company's current ownership structure is beholden to the Chinese government and poses a U.S. national security threat. TikTok has denied those allegations. The bill now goes to the Senate, where its prospects are unclear. A report released Wednesday shows migrants are paid less than Australian-born workers. The study found that migrants who have been in Australia for 2 to 6 years earn around 10% less than their locally born counterparts. It also found women migrants with a postgraduate degree earn on average 31% less than Australian-born women in the workforce with similar qualifications. A proposal to install new leadership in Haiti appears to be crumbling, as some political parties rejected the plan to create a presidential council that would manage the transition. The panel would be responsible for selecting an interim prime minister and a council of ministers that would attempt to chart a new path for the Caribbean country. In Africa, gunmen who kidnapped 286 students and staff from a school in northern Nigeria last week have demanded just more than $620,000 for their release. That's according to a spokesperson for the families of the hostages and a local counselor who spoke to Reuters News. Now, that request comes as police in Nigeria have ordered the creation of a new base for officers and the deployment of special forces in a remote village in northwest Kaduna State where the students were abducted. Timothy Obizu has that part of the story.
The Nigerian police chief Kayode Egbetokun announced plans for the new base and the deployment during a visit with Kaduna Governor Uba Sani on Tuesday. He said the steps will help restore residents' confidence in their safety while security forces continue the search for the missing students. Last Thursday, armed bandits on motorbikes invaded an elementary school in the village of Kuriga in Kaduna State and abducted 287 school students, the highest single abduction of students in years. Days after the attack, in a separate incident, bandits kidnapped 61 people from Kajuru District, about 150 kilometers away. The new police base will be in Kuriga and deployment of extra officers to the area has begun. Egbetokun says authorities are working to secure the abductees' release.
We are launching the Special Intervention Squad for Kaduna State, if only to give confidence to the people. The men will be deployed, and with the support that you have pledged to give, I'm sure that the community will start to feel safe again.
Governor Sani is hopeful the police operations will be successful.
We are extremely confident that the school children, by the grace of God, will come back safely. And I'm also happy with the decision by the Instructor of Police to quickly deploy a mobile base in our Kuriga community.
Last week, local media reported more than 300 women and children were kidnapped in northeastern Borno State by Islamic militants while they were gathering firewood. Insecurity is a major challenge for President Bola Tinubu, who launched an initiative called Renewed Hope after assuming office last May. The recent kidnappings are blamed, in part, on the absence of security forces in those remote areas. Last month, the president met with all 36 state governors to discuss decentralizing Nigeria's police force and creating a police arm for each state. Analyst Kabiru Adamu of Beacon Security says, if organized properly, this could be a step in the right direction.
There are gaps within the security architecture. I'm supportive of the decentralization of policing. But I think what we need more than anything is accountability. So that by the time we create the state police, that accountability element that has been created at the federal level will trickle down to the state level.
Years of fighting Islamist militants and crime gangs have stretched Nigerian security forces thin. Many are hoping the creation of new bases and state police arms will help keep the kidnappers away. Timothy Obizu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Giorgia Meloni's Italian government is planning on implementing a new strategy that could extend jail sentences for inmates. Reuters' Sean Hogan explains why. The plan worries some.
Prisons across Italy are facing protest action, including beating on cell bars or refusing to work or eat. But Giorgia Meloni's government has responded by threatening to make protesting a criminal offence, which could double their jail time. A draconian crackdown that experts say has no parallel in any other Western democracy. The prospect troubles legal experts like University of Milan's Angela Della Bella, who say the real problem is overcrowding and understaffing, making it difficult for inmates to access health, psychiatric and educational services.
Especially in overcrowded prisons with no opportunities for rehabilitation, it does not reduce crime. Statistics show that those who experience a detrimental detention situation to their dignity are not rehabilitated and are likely to continue or even commit more crimes. The cultural message that needs to be conveyed is that more prisons do not equal more security.
In Milan's main San Vittore prison, built in the 1800s, a guard with 35 years' experience said problems were growing in managing inmates who are mostly migrants, unable to speak Italian and still awaiting trial. Italy's prisons housed almost 61,000 inmates at the end of January, 10,000 more than the official capacity, according to data from Antigone, a prisoners' welfare organisation. At the same time, there is a shortfall of almost 7,000 guards. Meanwhile, suicides in Italy's prisons have increased to 21 this year, up from 9 at the same stage of 2023. Antigone's data shows. Here's their president, Patrizio Gonella, on the new security bill.
It is essentially a constitutional setback. It is a return to the past, an erosion of the rule of law slowly progressing in areas where we are not accustomed to seeing such interventions in criminal and immigration matters.
Andrea Del Mastro, Italy's junior justice minister with responsibility for the prison system, declined to comment on the proposal to criminalise passive resistance in jails, but said prison misconduct in general cannot be tolerated. The bill was presented in November and is now before Parliament, where an ample majority should prevent any resistance to its approval.
Sean Hogan of Reuters News. The judge overseeing the Georgia election interference case has dismissed some of the charges against former President Donald Trump, but others do remain. VOA's Rick Pantaleo has those details.
Fulton County, Georgia Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee wrote Wednesday in an order that six of the charges in the indictment must be quashed, including three against the ex-president. The judge's order leaves intact many other charges in the indictment. Judge McAfee wrote that prosecutors could seek a new indictment on the charges he dismissed. The six charges in question have to do with soliciting elected officials to violate their oaths of office. That includes two charges related to the phone call Trump made to fellow Republican Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger on January 2, 2021. Trump denies any wrongdoing. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
On Tuesday, both U.S. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump secured enough delegates to become their respective party's nominee in this year's general election, and setting up a repeat of the 2020 election and something the United States has not seen since 1956, when Republican President Dwight D. Eisenhower again defeated Adlai Stevenson, the Democratic opponent he had 4 years prior. I asked Augusta University political science professor Craig Albert why these events don't happen more frequently.
Typically, if a candidate loses an election, the national parties are going to do their research and see what were the main faults, what didn't the public like about the candidates. And even if they're still popular within the party, they're going to choose a different candidate that kind of atones for the fallacies that the public saw in those candidates in the first place. So it's such a big stage, right? The presidency. So if you lose that, it's that's your shot. That was your chance. There was something about you that the public didn't like, or that the other person got better on the other side. And so the national parties are going to do their research to see if they can fix and fine tune those in you as a candidate, if they're going to let you run for election again, or if it's better to like cut their losses and try to go with a new rising dominant superstar. The problem today, of course, is that both political parties just can't find the right young-ish superstar to run for the highest offices in the land right now. So they're sticking to their best case situations, their best case scenarios, which for the Democrats is Biden, and for the Republicans, I say, is former President Trump.
Craig Albert of Augusta University. In Washington, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Josep Borrell, the EU's High Representative for Foreign Policy, sharing with reporters at the meeting the close nature of the ties between the United States and the European Union.
We're grateful for the partnership, the strength of that partnership, and the fact that on so many of the critical issues that we have to face, there's extraordinary convergence between the United States and the European Union.
Both officials highlighted Russia's ongoing war with Ukraine as a priority, with Borrell describing it as the EU's biggest and immediate worry.
The world is becoming darker and darker. That's all he told to the Security Council yesterday. And the developments around us made our security inseparable and only proved the need for the US and UE to work together. We are facing an aggressive Russia who will not stop.
The leaders also focused on the humanitarian aid situation in Gaza. Now, going back to the topic of Russia, the United States is paying close attention to the latest round of its nuclear saber-rattling, worried each threat could bring Moscow and Washington a small step closer to a nuclear conflict. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden continues our coverage.
U.S. intelligence officials say it would be foolish to be intimidated by Russia's nuclear threats, but they also say it would be equally foolish not to pay attention.
Something's going on there.
The National Nuclear Security Administration's Frank Rose speaking to an audience in Washington.
We are trying to talk to the Russians, but quite frankly, every time we try to engage on these issues, we are rebuffed.
Rose's comments follow the latest warning from Russian President Vladimir Putin. Of course we are ready, Putin says, asked about the prospects of a nuclear war. The White House says such comments are reckless and irresponsible. A senior U.S. official says, despite Putin's threats, the U.S. has not seen any reason to adjust its own nuclear posture. Earlier this week, U.S. Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines told lawmakers Russia's ongoing struggles in its war against Ukraine are reason for worry.
We remain concerned that Moscow will put at risk longstanding global norms against the use of asymmetric or strategically destabilizing weapons.
A U.S. intelligence report this week further warns Russia sees its nuclear arsenal as, quote, the ultimate guarantor of the Russian Federation. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
And finally, new figures from the United Nations have estimated that the world hit a record low for deaths in babies and children younger than five in 2022, with Malawi among countries highlighted for their progress. Reuters' David Doyle rounds us out.
Malawi, alongside Cambodia, Rwanda, and Mongolia, have all been credited with a more than 75% drop in under five mortality since 2000. In the Malawian town of Nemetete earlier this year, parents like Secret Gibson were queuing up to get their children vaccinated against malaria, under a new program being rolled out in countries across the continent.
When a child receives the vaccine like this, it means as he grows, he will be a healthy and strong person. But also, as he attains maturity, it's like you have already laid a good foundation for him.
Preventable and treatable causes such as pneumonia, diarrhea, and malaria made up the majority of the 4.9 million under 5 deaths in 2022. While that's a halving of the mortality rate since 2000, it also still represents one death every 6 seconds. And the UN warned that the world is behind in its goals for reducing preventable deaths by 2030, with progress slowing since 2015. Overall, deaths of babies and children under 5 in 2022 were concentrated in sub-Saharan Africa. It represented 57% of the global total, despite only accounting for around 30% of the live births that year. The UN said better access to primary healthcare and community health workers could vastly improve the outlook.
David Doyle of Reuters News, and on behalf of everyone here at VOA, we thank you for joining us. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is designating two individuals and five entities associated with the Intellexa Consortium for their role in developing, operating, and distributing commercial spyware technology that has been misused to target Americans, including U.S. government officials, journalists, and policy experts. Based in Greece, the Intellexa Consortium is a collective of international decentralized companies that offer commercial spyware and surveillance tools to enable targeted and mass surveillance campaigns. Packaged under the brand name Predator Spyware, it is a suite of tools that can infiltrate a range of electronic devices. It can be used to harvest data, geolocation tracking, and enable access to a variety of applications and personal information on the infected devices. Intellexa Consortium's customer base is global. Already, the Predator Spyware suite has been deployed by numerous governments to facilitate repression and enable human rights abuses, including to intimidate political opponents and curb dissent, limit freedom of expression, and monitor and target activists and journalists. Even individuals within democratic governments have misused this commercial spyware to target their citizens without proper legal authorization, safeguards, and oversight. Pursuant to Executive Order 13694, as amended by Executive Order 13757, the U.S. Department of Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, designated Tal Jonathan Dillian and Sarah Alexandra Faisal Hamo for being the key enablers of the Intellexa Consortium. Dillian, a former Israeli military officer, is Intellexa's founder and the architect behind the Predator spyware tools. He fully or partially controls the company's associated with the consortium. Hamo is a corporate offshoring specialist who has provided managerial services to the Intellexa Consortium. In addition to the Intellexa Consortium, four companies within the consortium were also sanctioned. They are Ireland-based Intellexa Limited, North Macedonia-based Cytrox AD, Hungary-based Cytrox Holdings ZRT, and Ireland-based Thalestris Limited. Today's actions represent a tangible step forward in discouraging the misuse of commercial surveillance tools, which increasingly present a security risk to the United States and our citizens, said Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Brian E. Nelson. The United States remains focused on establishing clear guardrails for the responsible development and use of these technologies, while also ensuring the protection of human rights and civil liberties of individuals around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.